Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Today, our topic is legal tender laws, competing currencies, and the blessings of deflation with Dr. George Guido Holzman. Welcome, Guido.
Welcome, Michael. Nice to be with you.
I'm really happy that you could be here with us. So, folks, you should know that Dr. Holzman is a professor of economics at the University of Angers in France. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Angers. That's
Angers. Thank
yes,
you.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
I appreciate that. He is the author of many books, including The Ethics of Money Production and Deflation and Liberty. He is also on the senior faculty of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. So, Guido, let's get started talking about the blessings of deflation, since, as you say, it is the great scarecrow used by government to deflect attention away from inflation. And so we don't get too technical for people. Let's just use the common definition of deflation. Would you please give that to us?
The common textbook definition today is that deflation is a permanent decrease of the price level.
Okay. Can we also say that the value of money in our pockets goes up?
Right.
Okay, as well as prices going down.
Yeah, so this is the opposite side of the coin, right?
Okay.
If our money prices go up, then of course your purchasing power per unit of money goes down, and the other way around, if prices go down, then you can buy more with each dollar.
Okay. Who benefits by prices going down?
Well, it's difficult to single out a single group that would benefit from this, because if all prices go down, then all revenues also go down.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, you are winning because prices go down, you pay less for goods and services that you consume, for example.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, your revenue also tends to shrink. So
for businesses.
Right, so your
like
real revenue might be just the same as before.
So for savers, the elderly, and the consumers, they would be significant beneficiaries of this.
Well, again, it always depends on how your revenue is modified as compared to the sinking consumer goods prices.
Mm-hmm.
If you are a saver and you have, for example, invested in fixed income assets or in assets the value of which does not fall as much as the consumer goods prices, then of course you are winning.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have invested in things that fall even stronger in price than the consumer goods prices, then you are losing.
Mm-hmm. Well, but in general we could say that the consumer benefits if their money buys more and if their purchasing power becomes stronger.
Yeah, in their capacity as consumer, right?
Yes.
But again, it's we cannot say that it's beneficial for, let's say, the citizens as consumers, because the citizens as consumers can only spend the money that they also earn somewhere else
mm-hmm.
in the economy, either
mm-hmm.
from their savings or from their labor.
Mm-hmm.
I must insist on this point because it's a very widespread fallacy that you just say, well, it's magnificent from the point of view of consumers. We always need to keep in mind that the relative consideration or the relevant consideration
mm-hmm.
is how the prices evolve relative to your income.
Mm-hmm.
So deflation is not, generally speaking, beneficial for consumers or for any other group.
Well, you know what, we both understand that deflation actually, as we're talking about it here, I'm really trying to lead to a series of questions to the 1880s, which was a period of a decade where there was consistent deflation.
Right.
And there was a great benefit to the consumers.
Exactly.
And so, you know, for the, rather than
what happened in those days was that the monetary revenue of the consumers was by and large stable or diminished only slightly, whereas consumer prices were dropping dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, you get precisely this phenomenon that although all prices diminish, some prices diminish more stronger than others, and you get a beneficial impact, therefore.
Well, this is good. We're going to have to, dig this apart a little bit more.
Yes.
And so when we come back, we'll continue with Dr. Holzman on the blessings of deflation. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay. So please stay with us. We'll be back right after the break. And welcome back. We have Dr. Holzman with us today, and we are talking about deflation, the blessings of deflation. That's our first topic for this particular show. And one of the most interesting points that you just made, Guido, is that the price level itself is not something that we should really be concerned with.
Absolutely, right? Because, again, for the functioning of a market economy, it is never important how much money in the absolute people spend, but how that what they earn relates to the money that they have to spend on the goods that they need.
Mm-hmm.
And so an economy, and for companies, of course, this is the point of view of consumers. For mm-hmm. companies, what is important is how much money they earn relative to how much money they need to spend on the factors of production, so mm-hmm. on the laborers that they hire and raw materials that they buy and so on.
So let's ask you from a different angle. Can an economy have both price deflation, where prices are going down, and the economy is growing at the same time?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
And that is what we have observed in several instances.
Is that what
in
we
the past.
Want?
It is. Well, I mean, as we have said before, ultimately the price level is not very relevant, but there's nothing that speaks against it. So
mm-hmm.
if vigorous growth comes along with falling prices, that is not worse or better than any other form. We should just rejoice, and we should especially not fear the this phenomenon of falling prices.
Well, we've had we currently see some falling prices that we've seen consistently for the last 30 years in growth industries like electronics.
Exactly.
You know, TVs, computers,
right.
and other technologies like LASIK eye surgery, where the cost is less and
yeah,
improve
also
the
think
benefits.
Yeah, also think just of consumer goods that are not even electronics, but food and other things, toys, which have been growth industries on a planetary scale, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we have the phenomenon of globalization, with the mm-hmm. strong growth of the world economy, mm-hmm. which have entailed diminishing prices for consumers in the West and in other countries, parts of the world economy.
So let me ask you this. We used an example in a show recently that I had with Doug French, where he described some examples from the 1880s in the United States,
right.
which was the decade of fastest economic growth in U.S. history.
Exactly.
Yeah. Can you talk about that a little
curiously,
bit?
This period was before the 1930s when we had the Great Depression.
Yeah.
This period in the 1880s and 1890s was known as the Great Depression because it was a period of protectively falling prices, consumer goods prices in particular. But if we then look at the growth rates of that period, we find it was in fact the strongest growth period in all of American history.
Wow, that's very interesting. So, you know, I wanted to also go back into this other concept that you have about one of the advantages that deflation has, one of the most interesting that I got out of reading your book, Deflation and Liberty, is that it exposes the winners and the losers. Could you
exactly.
talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. What a deflation does is to, in our current monetary system, is to create problems for those who have inflated the money supply previously through fractional reserve banking in
mm-hmm.
particular. So fractional reserve banks have issued created demand deposits way in excess of the money that their customers have deposited with them.
Mm-hmm.
And this benefits the banker
mm-hmm.
and those customers who profit from the credits that they grant. But, of course, it goes to the disadvantage of all other market participants because
mm-hmm.
you increase the money supply and, therefore, the purchasing power per unit diminishes.
Mm-hmm.
Right? As the money supply goes up, all things become more expensive. So the value of the dollar in the hands of all other people diminishes.
Mm-hmm. This would hurt people that are trying to save money, for sure.
Exactly. Now, what happens then in a deflation? If a deflation hits the economy, it creates problems for fractional reserve banks. They might not be able to continue their operations, might not be able to fulfill their contractual obligations, and as a consequence, they go bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a problem for these banks and for their business partners.
Sure.
The credit dries up and so on.
Right.
So they are clearly the losers in this process. On the other hand, they are then the winners. The winners are all other people because as a consequence of this deflation, the price level will diminish very dramatically. So their money buys more things. And also people who work, who finance their investments less with credit, but more out of their own money, out of equity.
Mm-hmm.
So deflation benefits an equity economy, property owner
right.
economy, to the detriment of a debt economy.
So I want to summarize this by something you wrote in Deflation and Liberty, that deflation entails visible misery for many people to the benefit of equally visible winners. This starkly contrasts with inflation, which creates anonymous winners at the expense of anonymous losers. Inflation is a secret ripoff.
Yes.
I thought that was very interesting summary statement that you put in on that. Well, you know, this is interesting. You just mentioned this concept. I want to go back to this as a, in so far as it may be a potential boon to savers. It seems to me that in a general deflationary economy, they would know that their purchasing power would go up over time, and it sounds like an incentive to me for them to save.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, whereas people might be prone to save to start new businesses, but also let's talk about those who get hurt by deflation. You know, basically, it's all debtors, essentially.
That is true. Right? So because their revenue will diminish, and they still have to pay back the debt that they contracted at a higher price level in the past.
So from a practical perspective, deflation, if it were to happen suddenly, would be a psychological event most people couldn't survive. It would be really very difficult. But if it
very
happened,
hot,
yeah. But if it was gradual, there would be a massive shift in psychology, and we all have the ability to adjust. Obviously, it would be better if it was gradual and then sudden. Just like we wouldn't like hyperinflation.
Right. Absolutely.
You know,
You're right, Michael.
We cannot adjust if that is too quick.
In underlining this point that it would entail a shift in psychology, because we have been living now for almost 100 years in an inflationary monetary system, which has shaped not only the way we do business, but really the way we approach economic problems and economic decisions in everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
And this, would profoundly change if we reverted to a more sound monetary system, which has a slight deflationary tendency, and it would bring us back closer also to the moral values that were held by our ancestors.
And on that particular point, you know, in that late 19th century era, how young people were taught to provide for their own retirement is that they assumed that the money that they saved would retain and possibly even improve its value.
Absolutely.
You know, and that is in such sharp contrast from what we have today with our paper, as you said, and I love this term, forced money, you know, as paper money, and we're going to talk more about that in a little bit. But now we plan for our future to be worth, our money to be worth less and less and less over time.
Today it's suicidal if you make your savings, for example, in cash. Right? You know that its purchasing power will be a third or something in 20 years or 25 years. So nobody has a strong incentive to keep dollars, but to spend them as fast as possible.
Well, I want to, I don't think we'll get through all of this before our next break, but we'll get started with this right now. I particularly loved in your book, Deflation and Liberty, which again I'm going to recommend to all of our listeners. You had a total of 6 reasons why deflation is the harbinger of liberty, as you call it. And I'll ask if you would please comment on each of them. First, it stops inflation.
Yes, this is a very good thing. Deflation curtails the power of banks to create more money. So as a consequence, the amount of credit and money created by banks is not as big as before. It even diminishes. So there is no longer the redistribution. Also, this is the main negative impact of inflationary finance. It no longer redistributes real revenues to the benefit of bankers and the corporate customers, and to the detriment of all other people.
We're going to probably overlap some of your your answers are probably going to overlap because this is something that you understand so intimately, and our listeners understand so little. So please excuse me as I go through this, and we try to approach it from the slightly different way. But the second harbinger of liberty, you note, and you partially discussed it just now, is that it destroys the institutions that produce inflation.
Right.
And that's really cool.
Yes, this is a very nice thing about deflation.
Yeah. And so,
right before we said that ultimately the price level doesn't matter, mm-hmm. right, for from the overall point of view.
Right.
But again, if we have an inflationary situation, then certain people or certain institutions, again, banks, the financial sector, win at the expense of other people.
Right.
And in a deflation, it's the other way around. The financial sector is curtailed to some healthy proportion within the economy, and the winners are all those who spend their own money rather than money that they borrow.
Who save and actually engage in longer-term economic calculation.
Yes.
Which is actually, it supports a more moral society.
Yes.
So that's also good. Now we're going to run out of time even before I get through the question on this next one, but I'm going to even go ahead and say it anyway, and then we'll come back. The third harbinger you list is that it abolishes the advantage that the inflation-based debt finance enjoys over savings-based equity finance.
Right.
And where basically wipes out debt but not equity.
Yes.
And so we're going to, so like I said, we didn't even have time to have you answer on that except for a yes. So we'll be coming back right after the break, folks. And so please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay. And with me is Dr. Guido Holtzman. And we are talking about, at this particular segment of our show, the blessings of deflation. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and we're with Dr. Guido Holtzman. And, Guido, we were just talking about how the third harbinger of liberty, that, as you call it, of deflation, is that it wipes out debt, but not equity.
That is right. Let me give you an example to show that in an inflationary environment, there's a very strong incentive to go into debt, whereas the same would not hold true in a deflationary environment. So if you expect all prices to increase, therefore also your monetary revenue to increase, you have a very strong incentive to go into debt right now, mm-hmm. for example, to buy a home.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what virtually everybody does today, not right. only in the United States, but also in Western Europe. And this is a perfectly rational strategy to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you go into debt now, you take out, whatever, $300,000, and you pay whatever. $15,000 or $20,000 as a debt service per year, and at the beginning maybe your revenue is not particularly high. Maybe you just have a $60,000, so it's somewhat hard on family finances. It's almost 30%, but then as you go along and there's inflation, ever more money is pumped into the economy, so all prices go up, but your revenue will also rise. So even if you do the same work as before, let's say you're not a particularly smart or ambitious person, I mean, for doing the same work in 20 years or in 30 years, you will earn just $120,000 just because everybody spends much more money.
Mm-hmm.
So now, out of $120,000, the debt service of $20,000, of course, much lighter than before, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody anticipates this and therefore goes into debt. Whereas our great-grandfathers, working at the beginning of the 20th century, when we barely had any inflation at all, but rather a deflationary environment, were first accumulating savings,
mm-hmm.
didn't spend them right away,
mm-hmm.
and once they had enough saved, they were buying a house. It would have been suicidal for them to go into debt.
Mm-hmm.
So you have all this accumulation of equity.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very sound basis, very sound finance. You're standing with both feet on financial rock bottom, and then you buy the goods that you need.
I love this particular point. People have asked me if they should get into debt if they are anticipating higher inflation. And I tell them, well, the one thing that you're not thinking about is whether or not you're going to continue to have cash flow. Because if you suddenly have your cash flow interrupted and you've put all these logs of debt on your back, then that's going to be crushing, for you.
Yeah. So and this is another aspect, which, by the way, I did not underline very much in my book, but it's true. Right? I mean, as long as the inflationary period is stable and there's the economy runs by and large smoothly, so you have no interruption of revenue, it works out. But in a way, of course, it's almost like gambling. It's a little gambling,
yes.
Right? We are always speculating right. that you might earn a higher revenue in the future. So this is one of the character distorting
right.
influences. That
actually, I wasn't
going to
bring this up just now, but that is one of the things that is quite obvious about inflation, is that it does induce people to take on an inflationary psychology.
Yes.
Or, excuse me, a speculative psychology.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And,
but it's an inflationary psychology. I'm very glad for this expression.
Okay. So the fourth harbinger of liberty is that it decentralizes the financial decision-making and makes banks, firms, and individuals more prudent and self-reliant than they would have been under inflation.
Right. Under inflation, we have a system that is based on central banks and the ability of central banks to refinance commercial banks. If you have a strong deflationary environment, it's not worthwhile for banks to issue that much money, or that their ability to issue credit is curtailed. But then they don't need the assistance of a central bank. They don't need a system of immaterial fiat money underlying the system, so they are much more self-reliant. Also, much more in touch with their customer, right? The relative importance for them of their customer increases relative to the importance of assistance from the central bank.
Right. So I listed the next two as what I consider to be actually most important, but I just see them as conjoined. And so the fifth and the sixth are: deflation eradicates the rechanneling of incomes that result from the monopoly privileges of central banks. It thus destroys the economic basis of the false elites and obliges them to become true elites rather quickly, or abdicate and make way for new entrepreneurs and other social leaders. I like that. Yeah. Abdicate rather quickly.
That's very cute. Yeah, yeah, the idea is that in a market economy, you can reach a position of eminence only to the extent that you provide service to your fellow human beings. So if you're a business leader, it's because you have been demonstrated your ability to provide service to others.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you have an inflationary system, then there's also another factor that brings you to a position of eminence, to power, namely simply the friendship or the alliance with those who create money out of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, again, in a market economy, if people pay you, they pay you out of their own money, money that they have earned with the sweat of their brow, so then themselves can spend you. They spend money on you only to the extent that they themselves have provided services to others.
Mm-hmm.
In an inflationary monetary system in which banks and central banks can create money out of nothing, they didn't have to provide any service to anybody else. So it's just out of their personal arbitrary friendship or favoritism and so on that they give you this assistance. You're no longer a true social leader.
Well, this is really great. Let me tell you, folks, we're going to have to take another break. But when we come back, we're going to ask Dr. Holzman, is deflation primarily a political problem? So don't give me a quick answer. I'll be right back. We'll be right back after the break. And so this is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay. And please stay with us. We'll be right back in just a minute. And we're back. And so, Guido, I wanted to ask you, just before the break, is deflation primarily a political problem?
Yeah, it's a political and a sociological problem. Again, as we have said before, it doesn't matter ultimately for the economy whether you're operating at a higher or at a lower price level. So the distinct differences that come into play between inflation and deflation concern essentially the distribution of revenues. If you have a deflation, and a deflation hits a highly indebted economy such as ours in the present day, then it's likely to hit debtors, right? Because, as we have said before, mm-hmm. their revenue will now diminish, but they still are in debt that they have contracted at a higher price level in the past. So they will not be able to pay back.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens in those cases very often is that the firms go bankrupt. And households, families go bust as well, right? They can no longer pay back the loan that they have, the mortgage that they've taken out to pay for the home.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens then is that the deflation entails a redistribution of the assets that exist in the economy. Because it's not because some people go bust that the things that they have owned up to now no longer exist, that they just evaporate. The firms are still there, right?
Right.
The buildings are there,
right.
And the raw materials and the people who are working for them. The house that houses are owned by families still exist.
Sure.
Right? It's only that they don't own them anymore.
Right, right, right.
So what happens then is that we get a huge redistribution mm-hmm. of productive assets from one set of the citizens, the indebted ones,
mm-hmm.
to the other ones who are less in debt or not in debt at all.
Now, you're characterizing this according to a very significant and rather sudden deflation.
Yes.
Yeah. And, yes. And that same thing would happen in a hyperinflation as well.
Yes.
And so, but in...
But then the winners and losers are different, right?
Right,
in
exactly.
In hyperinflation, it's the debtors who win constantly.
Right.
Right. And
exactly.
So those who have the closest contacts to banks and to right. central banks in particular...
First use of money.
Yes. They
yeah.
take it out. And yeah. Whereas in the case of a deflation, everybody could be... Everybody who has been conservative in, mm-hmm. in their, or halfway conservative in their finance is likely to be a winner.
So, you know, the reason this is so such an important distinction is because most of the people that are listening to this this particular broadcast do not have a central banker as their best friend.
Are not very unusual.
And they are probably not the first user or even the second user
yes.
of the money.
Yes.
And probably they're very much closer to Main Street than Wall Street.
Right.
And so for them, deflation is actually either small d in a more gradual sense
yes.
or a big
yeah.
d even.
Yeah.
More of a friend.
The worst that can happen to them, and actually this will is likely to happen to many people, to many citizens, is they would lose their house.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, Michael, I mean, if you own a house with 10% that you have put down on the table and 90% mm-hmm. that you owe to your banker,
mm-hmm.
you don't really own the house.
Right.
So what happens then? Let's say you have a massive default of households
mm-hmm.
in the United States,
which we already have.
Which we already have, but then yeah. it would be across the board, would be much more dramatic if we had any significant deflation. Let's say the prices would now diminish by 30% or something like this.
Mm-hmm.
This would hit everybody, the
mm-hmm.
entire country.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think that this is actually a reason for much concern. I mean, bankruptcy laws are pretty liberal in the United States,
mm-hmm.
so as a family you get out of this very, very fast.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do then? Well, you will rent a house.
Mm-hmm.
And after deflation, there will be a lot of houses for rent,
right.
and for rent at very low prices.
Right.
So it's not that you will be without a roof.
Right.
Right. You will simply, for a while, rent the place until, finally, you have built up your savings again, then you buy the place.
Exactly.
Right.
And even in some states, and I'm not really conversant with all of them, but I know that there are some states that have what they call homestead laws that disallow you from losing your house if you go through bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is also out there. But on this particular point about it being a political problem, you mentioned that deflation is a fight. The deflation fight is a special interest fight to protect the existing establishment.
Right.
I thought that was a very, very profound statement. Now, does deflation bring us back in touch with a more real world?
Yes, to the extent that, again, inflationary finance is based on the goodwill of those who create money artificially out of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So they have not provided any real service. It's just really their mere opinion or their mere friendship, their mere will that certain things be such and such. So they finance projects just because they like them,
mm-hmm.
not because they have earned the support of the rest of the citizens that puts them in the position now to spend that money.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get out of touch with reality because anything is possible once you start financing things with a printing machine.
I have a quote from you that is also from your book. It says, it brings the entire society back in touch with the real world because it destroys the economic basis of the social engineers, spin doctors, and brainwashers.
You don't like to mince words much,
do you? No, I mean, things should be said clearly and honestly. And I think it's a fairly accurate description of the current state of affairs. Of course, in a completely free society, would still have people of this sort, but much less.
Sure, sure.
Right? Because right now, who is the biggest employer of these likes?
Right.
It's the government.
Right.
It's banks.
Who get the money first or
exactly.
second.
Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. So that's a very important point. So let's talk about the cleansing effect of deflation. Now, as it pertains to this current crisis, how would deflation actually be of benefit as we're dealing with our current crisis that we're dealing with right now?
So the problem that you have in a crisis is that in the past you've invested in the wrong projects, and in our particular crisis we also have a huge debt problem. So you're in way too much debt, and you cannot really move.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So what deflation does is, as we have seen before, it redistributes assets, that is, assets that have not been productively used by the past investors are now reshuffled to investors who will use them differently.
Mm-hmm.
This entails, well, sometimes bankruptcy, and some companies will actually be closed and so on, others will be set up.
Mm-hmm.
And what deflation also does is to get us rid of our debt problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because deflation, as we have seen, entails bankruptcy, mm-hmm. the inability to pay back.
Mm-hmm.
So then the assets formerly belonging to the debtor revert back now to his creditor,
mm-hmm.
and the debt disappears.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And once you have a big meltdown, deflationary meltdown of the economy, what the meltdown really means is not that the real economy melts down because all the physical stuff is still there. What it means is that the debt melts down.
Mm-hmm.
There's no more debt after this whole process.
I wanted to read one other thing that you had written about this, that the dangers of deflation are, and I'm going to mispronounce this word, chimerical.
I don't know how you pronounce
it. I don't know how we pronounce it because it's not a word I've ever used, really.
I would say chimerical, yes.
Chimerical. But its charms are very real. There is absolutely no reason to be concerned about the economic effects of deflation unless one equates the welfare of the nation with the welfare of its false elites. Yeah, I thought that pretty much summed that up. So some of the listeners may still have some questions about fiat, what we call, and since you've named it forced money, we've adopted that particular phrase. Please briefly explain what is forced money and why is it called fiat?
So fiat money is a particular kind of forced money. So forced money is the general thing, right? Forced money is money that is forced on the users by some violations of property rights. For example, if I, as a banker, I'm fraudulent and I represent a demand deposit that I've created or a banknote that I've created as being fully covered by gold or silver that I hold in my vault, then this is a sort of forced money.
Mm-hmm.
Because I use a violation of property rights, in this case fraud, to get this whole thing into circulation.
Mm-hmm.
Another example for a violation of property rights would be I send out killers to take care of my competitors, so there are less competitors around, so my money is being used to a greater extent. This would also be forced money.
Mm-hmm.
And what fiat money is something else. Fiat money is a particular form of forced money. It's based on the force of the state,
right?
Which is different. So forced money could also exist if you have a private criminal,
uh-huh.
right?
Sure.
So he could create forced money.
Mm-hmm.
But fiat money is forced money created by the government. So it's not just the government is not a criminal. The government relies on the laws mm-hmm. of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not something that's done in hidden or some criminal niche, but it's being done openly based on legislation and due process and what have you. But still, it creates violations of private property rights that are now legitimized by the law, but still the violations remain. And so as a consequence, those monetary objects that benefit from the government's fiat, which is a Latin phrase, right? Which means I say so, so it
right.
shall be.
Right.
By my mere say-so, it shall be.
Right.
Those monetary objects now benefit. So we get central banks, which would not exist to the same extent on the free market. We get immaterial money, which nobody would have on a free market, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So we get three Fs. We get fiat, We get forced, and we get fear. So I waited to this part of the show to ask you now to talk about legal tender laws. And these are what give teeth to this forced fear money,
right.
This unsound fiat money. Please explain what legal tender laws are and just basically how they work, if you would, please.
Legal tender law gives special status to monetary objects, for example, to dollars. Dollars right now are legal tender in the United States, and that means that everybody has to accept them, even if he has made a contract denominated in some other good. For example, the two of us, we could make a contract. You sell me your car, I promise to pay you in euros. So we make a contract in euros. Mm-hmm. And so you hand over my car, then I could come, because of the legal tender law, and pay you in dollars, even though we stipulated in our contract that you be paid in euros.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the legal tender law gives every debtor the right to pay back in terms of a money that has not been stipulated in the contract, to override the contract, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you know, we see every day multiple kinds of money, and we're just not used to noticing them as money. Like, for example, well, maybe we don't see these every day, beer garden tokens and bus tokens, but and chips at a casino, they would be considered money. I actually don't go to casinos, so I don't see them very much. But even coupons at grocery stores, you know,
yes,
basically are, yeah, what you would call a money substitute, loosely defined. And but these are allowed, which shows that there's some relaxation of legal tender laws in for example, here in the United States, where on our bills it says, you know, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private.
Yes.
And so
yeah, well, I mean, the legal tender law gives the debtor the right to override the previous contract.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the most important example of a debtor is, of course, the government, mm-hmm, the government itself.
Mm-hmm.
Government's usual, but the U.S. government, of course, does not make any contract in denominated in other things but the dollar, so the problem doesn't really pose itself.
Right, exactly. And actually, mm-hmm, that was actually my next point.
Yeah.
I was going to read that. But contracts, but as for contracts, mm-hmm, I cannot use salt, ammunition, mm-hmm, or gold for contracts, actually, in the United States.
Well, you could use it, but it could not be enforced in
the
court.
Point. Right, exactly. I could use it in a voluntary exchange, mm-hmm, but I have no legal protections if I want to use it. And that's, if I want legal protections, I have to use the so-called forced fear money, forced fear fiat money. We'll get this right sooner or later. So for day-to-day use, for businesses, paying taxes, going out to dinner, we have to use this forced fear, fiat, digital. We'll have to come up with another F for digital money.
Yeah.
Fake. Something like that. I read a quote some time back that the problem with legal tender laws are that they inhibit or prohibit people's ability to flee a depreciating currency when they realize they are losing purchasing power of their money.
Right.
Please comment on that.
Well, I mean, if the dollar were to lose very rapidly its purchasing power, let's say we have an inflation rate of 10% or 15% per year, so there's a significant decline, so there would be a strong incentive now for U.S. citizens to use some other money,
mm-hmm,
for their daily exchanges. Mm-hmm. The problem is, as long as you have legal tender laws, you make any contract, the other person could still override this contract. So you would still be forced to accept dollars, mm-hmm, in lieu of the better money that you would actually like to use.
Yeah.
So these better monies then never really make it into the market, because the legal tender laws keep the dollar artificially, so the bad money artificially in its place.
Yeah, that's exactly, as I see it, the problem. they keep the bad money in front and center, because the entire legal system is set up around them.
Right.
And so now I'd like to bring up the idea of competing currencies. I recently read a report from Michigan where they listed different interesting ways that some businesses and citizens were coping with the depression that has already arrived in Michigan. And there was some gold and silver and copper that were being used for some meals at some restaurants and being accepted and exchanged. Silver at some gas stations for tanks of gas. And then
that's
there
amazing.
Was,
it's the first time I hear about this.
Yes, actually, I have a little article on it. And then there was a report of some barter of apple pies and even chickens for some medical services.
Okay.
This brings up two points that I would like to ask, and I'm not sure we'll get into both of them before the break, but are we more likely to see a shift to sound money and away from forced money from what I would call the bottom up, the people level, or from the top down, the government level?
I think we cannot expect right now anything good coming from the top level. So
yeah,
these things have to be solved by the citizens themselves. The difficulty is to ultimately to resist also the bad institutions that we have on the legal level. But the initiative must come from the bottom. The present inflationary system is in the interest of, unfortunately, of our politicians. So they're not likely to abolish this. They don't have a very strong personal incentive to do so.
Mm-hmm.
It's really something that must come from the bottom up, and it will come only to the extent that people understand what money does to them, what mm-hmm. the monetary system does to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're not going to have much time to go into this next topic point that I wanted to go into before we take our break. But when we come back, folks, we are going to discuss with Dr. Holzman some of the ordinary things that we ordinary people could do that perhaps might erode these legal tender laws, and some courageous politicians could do as well. So please stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and we'll talk to you in just a minute. Welcome back. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and we're now in our final segment with Dr. George Guido Holzman, and we're talking about the legal tender laws, competing currencies, and the blessings of deflation. And we were just talking about how we might, we as ordinary people, could possibly erode these legal tender laws. Now, Guido, first, we just discussed this example where we see people ignoring these legal tender laws, and at the grassroots level, where they're just saying basically no to paper.
That's a very nice motto.
There could be other ways where their local governments could hurry the transition into a more market money system, where I actually like the term personal choice money.
I think it's very important that you stress this point, right? The improvement will not come through the political imposition of some other form of money, which keeps the bad guys still in control of the money supply, and therefore allows them, once the present storm and also the angriness of people have settled, just to continue on the old way. So we need really putting money back into the hands of the people. This is the only way to make the citizen sovereign mm-hmm. in monetary affairs.
And I think it's really important for everyone that's listening to understand that they already now hold that power.
Yeah.
The real linchpin of the power that the state actually holds over our money is our use of the money.
That is
if
true.
We were to stop using that money and start mm-hmm. using alternative monies, we would actually be in a position to actually bring this house of cards down.
Yes, absolutely.
But we could do so in such a way that it actually could create an orderly transition into a better system.
Well, I mean,
and it may not be. Yeah. It may not be orderly.
Would not be orderly for the beneficiaries of the current system.
For the beneficiaries of the current system.
But at least
it to be orderly for them.
Right, but of course you're right. It's important that we have, so to say, the fallback position already in place, so that when the current system disintegrates,
right,
which it would eventually,
right,
that something else is already in place and could develop and could grow very quickly.
You know, this is a point I wasn't going to bring up, but it's a quote from Murray Rothbard's book, What Has Government Done to Our Money? And I really want to recommend this book to all our listeners as well.
Great book.
Embedded in the demand for money is knowledge of the money prices of the immediate past. So we have to be thinking in terms of the integration of the system that we have now
right.
with what's coming next.
Yeah. But for example, if people were now simply to start saying, okay, in our community in Michigan, we pay in silver. They mm-hmm. could use any silver coins mm-hmm. that are still around, or one ounce coins or even smaller denominations. Mm-hmm. And then say, okay, we're starting based on the current silver market prices, mm-hmm. which is whatever, $18 per ounce, mm-hmm. and then have things develop from there.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And people would actually figure that out. You know, there's a piece that I read some years ago that showed prices at a little store about 130 years ago in Connecticut. And it showed prices denominated in different kinds of money.
Yeah.
And this is the kind of thing that we would, I think, see.
The United States was the host of the last great experiment in competing monies, true monetary freedom, which was until the Civil War, in fact. Americans were using essentially foreign coins, also some national coins, but essentially foreign coins.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore you had different prices denominated in these different coins. Not all of the coins were circulating at each spot, but there's, for example, in New Mexico and California, they're essentially Mexican coins, whereas in Boston and so on, you had European coins.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're coming into the end of our show, and unfortunately, this really fun experience is going to come to an end. And so, Guido, I want to thank you very, very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Michael.
It's been a great privilege to have you on the show, and we look forward to having you on again.
Whenever.
Okay. This is Michael McKay in Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can download this and all of our shows for free. And until next week, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.